ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Clint Jasper, and you're listening to A Big Country on ABC Radio. Today, we jump off the city merry-go-round to find flower farmers who escaped busy city careers to move to Gympie in Queensland. We'll meet two endangered masked owls doing their part to raise money for the raptor refuge in Tasmania by posing as life models in an art class. And we join the volunteers digging for 95 million-year-old fossils at a dino dig at Winton.
I love it. I just love it. I'm a dinosaur tragic. I love minerals. I love rocks. I mean, if you've been interested in dinosaurs your whole life, why wouldn't you take the opportunity to participate? We've got all these specimens that are coming out of the ground. Some of them are not in jackets, they're in alfoil wrapping. But when we get them back to the lab, we then have to open them up and start removing the soil and stabilising the specimen and puzzling it all back together.
Soon we go to the Dinosaur Museum at Winton, but first, are you yearning to leave the big smoke behind? According to the Regional Australia Institute, more than 3 million Australians are keen to make the move, and the Institute wants more investment in the regions to meet that demand. So let's meet one of the couples who've escaped busy Melbourne to live in country Queensland, just northwest of Gympie. As Jennifer Nichols discovered, it's been an ideal location to get back to basics and create a picture-perfect flower farm.
What colour is this?
This one is a light pink ranunculus. Some people think they look like roses.
Love blossomed when Filipino-born Aussie city slicker Jennifer Nini met Ben Maguire at an IT recruitment company in Melbourne in 2008.
I grew up in Mullumbimby, Byron Bay, and just went to the city, bright lights at 18, see if I could, find my partner.
Oh, you found me.
While I enjoyed Melbourne's food, culture, entertainment, and being close to Jennifer's family and friends, life was hectic.
What I don't love about the city is just it is go, go, go. So There is no time to breathe, really. You're kind of swept up with the crowd and everyone's rushing. So you're also rushing because that's your norm. Your norm is to just keep going. And then even when you're off, you're on, if you know what I mean. You're still plugged in. You're not really disconnected. And so you're still stimulated, constantly stimulated from the time you walk out the door.
I don't think you realise that that's happening until you're in the bush or on a rural place, because then you look at the lifestyle you had and it's like, wow, that was, how did we do it? How were we in an apartment building?
The death of Ben's brother Mark made them rethink what they wanted in life.
Well, I thought that we should just leave the city and get into the bush. We hadn't really experienced that before and just wanted to change. My family was up this way as well, so it was good to get close to them, and Jen just was...
I had a house in Melbourne and I was like, okay, I'll just get my brother to mind it and I'll come up and let's see how we go.
In 2014, they settled on this 48-hectare off-grid property near Woolooga, more than an hour and a half drive northwest of the Sunshine Coast.
And then we loved it.
Jennifer Nini continued to work online and Ben Maguire in construction. Flower farming only came after COVID.
This used to be a greenhouse full of greens, food. And then when COVID hit, I'm like, I need to grow something for me, something that's beautiful. So I started growing flowers and it just took off.
The weather proved the biggest hurdle for the first generation farmers.
I'm like, wow, we're in the middle of a drought and you want to grow flowers on this farm. Then we had the floods, so she bought all the rain from wishing it.
After 2 years of hard work building garden beds, expanding the dam and learning how and what to grow, Flower Farmstead is thriving.
Smile. A little bit more down again.
Love this. Just I'm facing you. Yeah.
They're off-grid but connect with customers online, documenting their country life with photos and videos on Instagram.
Look how beautiful it is. All right, let's go here.
They found their tribe at farmers markets, selling sustainably grown, chemical-free blooms. What's been the most difficult thing about this move?
Income's been difficult when you're starting off a new farm. We've put a lot of money into it with all the machines. And
what's the best thing about living here?
Oh. Every morning, wake up and it's like, wow.
There's a sense of purpose. It gives us a sense of purpose and peace.
You're a bit deeper than me, so. For me, I just love waking up in the morning, having a nice coffee, and just the simple things in life, whereas Jen's more about, let's make a change.
There is so much work, and I think the outcome is absolutely beautiful. We are learning. This is still our second year.
And you change as well. Like, we had different ideas, so we put effort into this or that. At the moment, we're really focusing on this part of our life, the flowers.
Inviting others to enjoy a taste of life on the flower farm is their long-term goal. They're working towards a dream of offering romantic stays in tiny houses.
This is probably going to be another 10 years of solid everyday work to try to get, because we've got big goals of where we want to take it. So it's going to be a lot of work. But we love the work.
Yeah.
In the country, their neighbours live further away, but connections are closer.
Everyone's just so supportive and
just
so
in
lovely.
This little road, there's no shop or anything like that, but all the neighbours, there's a Facebook group, we all chat. A lot of the older people that were living here before us moved out, when there was a whole new group that sort of moved in at the same sort of time over the last 10 years. And yeah, it's been close. We go catch up with people, have a few, you know, beers and some dinner.
And everyone, you know, with the floods that happened last year, you're just there for each other.
Great community.
Oh, my goodness. Our neighbours and Gympie as a region, we couldn't ask for a better region. Like, we love it.
And it's probably, not certain, the lower leg bone of the dinosaur.
Over 20 years ago, a Queensland grazier made a chance discovery on his sprawling station, a single dinosaur bone. The fossil dated back 95 million years, and it kick-started the transformation of his tiny Dust Bowl town of Winton into a bustling science tourism hub.
It was 20 or 22 years previously that David had done the surface search and found all these lovely specimens, and some of them fitted exactly into place with pieces we found in the dig site. So the surface material was linking up with the bones that we were finding as we were digging, and that is super special. It gives me goosebumps thinking about it now.
I'm Karen Dean. Yes, it's my first time. I've been trying to come for sort of 3 years, but with COVID and everything else that's been going on, haven't been able to manage to get here. But finally, after 25 hours on the train, I arrived and it was great. So all the way up to Longreach and then another 2 hours on the bus to get to Winton. Well, I've always been interested in archaeological sort of things, even though this is paleontology, but wanted to come on a real actual dig. So we've been up to Longreach before and been out to Winton and to the museum and saw the things that you could come to this. And so then it's been on the list and my name's been on the waiting list for a while. So.
Under the scorching Queensland sun, this group of strangers are digging for bones that are 95 million years old. This is Belmont Station in western Queensland, where sheep and cattle roam above the land and dinosaurs lie beneath. Twice a year, dino enthusiasts travel from around Australia to spend a week in the outback unearthing bits of history. Paleontologist Dr. Matthew Hearn says they're at the forefront of new discoveries.
Just about every discovery we make out here is new, because it's a vast country. It's really hard to actually dig and find fossils, but that means that when you do find something, generally it's going to be new. So that's the excitement. That started off as a meagre tourist attraction, and with all the discoveries that have been made, people are hearing more and more about it in Australia, but also overseas. So the whole tourism potential has built. So over the last 20 years, I've seen this sort of grow and grow. And it's been great for the outback communities. A lot of tourists are coming here and spending time in Western Queensland, and they come and visit the various museums, including our museum. So it started off in a small way, actually on this station, Belmont, and it's just grown every year. It's become more exciting and more interesting, and people just actually keep coming back. We've got diggers that started off back in 2003, and they're still with us, coming back almost every year.
This is Ali Calvi's 14th dig.
I love it. I just love it. I'm a dinosaur tragic. I love minerals. I love rocks. I mean, if you've been interested in dinosaurs your whole life, why wouldn't you take the opportunity to participate?
In 2008, she was a tourist visiting the dig site But she's since moved to Winton and volunteers 5 days a week at Australia's Age of Dinosaurs Museum.
We've got all these specimens that are coming out of the ground. Some of them are not in jackets, they're in alfoil wrapping. But when we get them back to the lab, we then have to open them up and start removing the soil and stabilising the specimen and puzzling it all back together.
David Elliott was a grazier when he discovered a fossilised femur on his station, only 100 metres from where the dig site is today. 20 years later, he's the leading ambassador for paleotourism in Queensland. He says the week-long digs have been particularly popular with retirees.
I think they've got the time on their hands and they've still got plenty of skills and plenty of energy, and they want to go out there and contribute to something. And I think that's amazing, because that's what our museum can do, to take the whole country forward with paleontology and just natural history in general.
The Elliott family even have a dino named after them, the Savannosaurus elliottorum, after David's discovery in 2005. The long-necked plant-eating sauropod grew up to 15 metres long and would have weighed up to 20 tonnes. But they are still learning about it and searching for any fossils of its skull and teeth.
Most of what we got here are sauropod bones, you know, once you get to know a dig site, you know, and just keep chipping away. Sometimes you don't find much, sometimes you find, you know, virtually nearly a whole dinosaur.
So how old do you think these bones are?
Around 95 million years old.
Wow.
That's a fair bit of age there, yeah. Yeah, and this is from the Winton Formation, and so we were right on the edge of an inland sea, so the sea was really just kilometres away to the north for us. So that's amazing, isn't it? You know, just to think that, you know, where's, you know, what this would have been like in those days. You know, marine reptiles to the north, you know, and fish and all that sort of stuff, ocean, yeah.
What have you learnt over 20 years of running these digs?
What have I learnt? Well, I think probably the biggest thing I've learned over the years is that Rome wasn't built in a day. You know, you take small steps always, you know, but it's over time, it gets bigger and bigger, and you can then correlate bones that we might be finding this dig with something that dug up 20 years ago. The museum itself doesn't have a big research arm. We can't afford to pay them. But we can facilitate those researchers, universities, university students, people doing PhDs. We've had several PhDs done on the material here, on our own bones, you know, now. And I think that's amazing, because that's what our museum can do, to take the whole country forward with paleontology and just natural history in general.
Digging for dinosaurs is no walk in the Jurassic Park, as Ali well knows.
It's not a solo enterprise. This is a massive project that we all have to help each other with. Lifting buckets, plastering, it's not a single-handed job. You can't possibly do it on your own. It is a team activity.
Grazier David Elliott, who first discovered a fossilised femur bone on his station at Winton, the paleontologist Dr Matthew Hearn, and volunteer Ali Kelvey. Grace Nakamura was our reporter. You're listening to A Big Country with me, Clint Jasper. Soon the owls Monty and Bentley in their finest feathers pose for an art class in Tasmania. But first, we'll go to a farm in Victoria, one of only a handful growing gum trees that will have a special compound extracted that can be used in medicine.
And yeah, being the kind of the lighter paddock on the farm, you know, predominantly kind of buckshot country, as you can see.
Mark Valletta is a farmer who isn't afraid to try new things, and he's showing me one of his latest crops.
We usually put cattle in this paddock so they lose weight before calving, so to not take up high-end horticulture land. It's a really, really exciting new venture. I'm a mixed farmer based just south of Benalla. I run quite a diverse operation of cherries, grapes for wine, lucerne, Angus cattle, merino sheep, wild forage mushrooms, and the medicinal gum trees that we're here to see today.
In the northeast of Victoria, a new crop is growing that could one day be used to treat patients with diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and even long COVID. 8 farmers have planted their paddocks with plantations of medicinal gum trees, producing a variety that has a high concentrate of a compound that could be used in pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, it definitely piques people's interest, and they said, "Oh, medicinal gums. What's involved? Is it for the extraction of the oil?" And this is actually a compound that's in quite high concentrations called pinocymbrum. which has been shown to have some really good beneficial medical application in Alzheimer's and dementia and anti-inflammatory and antimicrobial qualities.
I'm Annie Brown, and Mark is showing me his latest crop, medicinal gum trees.
Funnily enough, a farmer mate of mine down the road, JP, he said, oh, there's a guy the farm next to me growing some interesting gum trees. I reckon it'd be right up your alley, Mark, and jumped the fence and went and caught up with Alistair. And anyway, he was kind enough to show us the original planting, and I noticed there was a little infestation of some sort of caterpillar, and I said, oh, you better kind of do something about this, otherwise you might not have a crop. And he said, oh, we're actually looking for other growers and someone with horticultural experience we'd really, you know, love to have involved. And from then I was when I found out that the project had really good backing from Swinburne University, Melbourne University, and there was a lot of research in and around it, I was like, wow, this is something I'm kind of really interested in. And a couple of years down the track, we're standing here in the trees, and you know, some of them are almost 10 foot high. So
Mark has 2,000 gum trees in his plantation and is one of a handful of growers around the Benalla region. The trees are grown for Australian biotech company Gretel's. The chief executive officer, Alistair Cumming, said they were originally looking for compounds that could be used to replace the use of antibiotics in livestock feed.
When we started this journey in 1978, I was at a conference at Massey University in New Zealand. And is that one of the key lecturers at that time stood up and made a comment in front of major pharmaceutical companies and representatives from around the world, is that the way that we're using antibiotics in livestock feed is going to lead to a potential problem as far as resistance was concerned. So that's when the journey started. At that time, I decided to meet some people from University of Melbourne School of Botany, which is now Biosciences, and got talking with them, and is that we applied for and achieved to get an ARC linkage grant, and is that we started looking at originally 188 different species of Australian flora. And out of that, we found one particular species which is in front of us at the present stage, which is a species which has got a high content of a compound called pinosimbrin.
How long, in terms of a timeline, how long before we would see a product from these medicinal gum trees available to people to try?
We're looking at having a functional food with this compound within the next 18 months. Easy.
Dr. Jason Goodger is a senior research fellow from the University of Melbourne. He researches chemicals found in plants, and he's been looking into what this compound can do.
So pinosimbrin is a pharmaceutical flavonoid that has particular advantages for diseases of the central nervous system and cardiopulmonary disorders. And we've done with Gretel some research on that, showing that it's really effective in treating lung fibrosis, for instance. Something a lot of people with long COVID, or those who've recovered from severe COVID, have a lot of scarring on their lungs. And compounds like pinosimbrin can treat that scarring really effectively.
Dr. Jason Goodger says it's not just flavonoids that are beneficial pharmaceuticals, and lots of plants could be grown for medicine. To quote him, nature is an amazing pharmacy. Now, the biotech company Gretel's has also opened a mill in Benalla to extract the compound. Alistair Cumming, chief executive of Gretel's, believes there is a whole world to discover.
The support that we've got from the local community as far as growers and everything else is concerned, it's just incredible. But these people have also got a passion, as much as I might have a passion, in being able to see something which is going to be able to not only offer different farming opportunities as well, utilising land which is not really ideal for broadacre cropping or grazing on everything else, something which is going to give the local area employment as well. It's a big project, but it's got a big opportunity. Is that I always have a favourite saying, is that it's out there. All we have to do is find it. Nature is the world's greatest scientist.
You're hearing the call of endangered Tasmanian masked owls. There are only 500 breeding pairs left in the wild, but this pair is not wild.
We do have them on a special perch, and they do have a little tether, so they can't fly around the room because there'd be poo absolutely everywhere.
Meet Montgomery and Bentley, Tasmanian masked owls. They were bred in captivity, and now they are part of the fundraising effort at the Raptor Refuge in southern Tasmania. While the refuge cares for other injured raptors, Monty and Bentley sit as life models.
Hi, my name's Juliet. I am the senior keeper at the Raptor Refuge.
Hi, my name's Kate. I am a volunteer slash admin person at the refuge.
Yeah, cool.
The owls' sweet, heart-shaped faces tilt and twist. They screech and call as artists capture their beautiful likeness. They were born in captivity, hand-reared, and are very comfortable with humans. My name is Lucy Cutting, and I've come to meet Juliet Harlow and Kate Shaw at Raptor Refuge in Kettering in southern Tasmania.
I've been here for about 9 years, and initially Craig just asked me what I like to do in my spare time. And I said, oh, I dabble in art, I like painting. And he's like, right, off you go then. My first job was painting a freezer. And I just stuck gum leaves on it, got some spray paint and did a nice little painting. Yeah. And Craig went, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, we got a bit carried away with the painting. As you can see, when you walk around the grounds.
It's everywhere.
And then Kate came along and Kate's like, oh, I can't do art very well. And I looked through a sketchbook and was just like, she's amazing. So we got Kate on board painting as well.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it's just grown. And we've done a few pieces together, like the barbecue and rocks down the driveway now. Bit of a challenge painting a rock rather than a sheet of paper.
It really has grown and it's turned into classes. Tell me about the classes that you're now running at Raptor Refuge.
So we do painting in our workshop. I think Catherine Cooper, a very well-known artist, she used to come out and do a painting workshop here many years ago, but she's just flat out busy, so that kind of dropped off. As we had Kate come along as well, we thought, hey, why don't Kate and I run some painting workshops here? And it's a great way to raise funds and get people out to the refuge and really understand these birds, especially the owls, because we don't get to see them very often because they're quite secretive at nighttime.
Kate, you mentioned that you kind of felt you weren't an artist, and you said this a couple of times now, actually. So what did you think about the idea of running actual art classes?
I was freaking out. It was more of a hobby. And then I didn't even tell anyone here for a while until I think Juliet and I got talking. I'm like, oh, yeah, I do a little bit. And then she stole my sketchbook. And I was busted. Then I was just told, okay, you're off painting now.
Yeah. How do the classes work that do run here? And who is the life model or life models that are featured?
We have two wonderful life models called Montgomery and Bentley. And they are Tasmanian masked owls that have been hand-reared here. So can't be released because they're too friendly around people, unfortunately. Their parents came into care here at the refuge many years ago. And sadly, they couldn't be released due to their injuries. They wouldn't survive. And they ended up getting a bit friendly. And we had some baby owls hatch out 1 year. And we went, oopsie daisies, what are we going to do with these? So this was about 8 years ago. They had one clutch of chicks hatch out and we watched them through a camera and observed them. But sadly, they all kept disappearing. We think maybe a rat was getting in the aviary or maybe they were getting squashed accidentally. So it was really upsetting. So the next clutch that hatched, we had two chicks. Again, one disappeared. So Craig decided to go up in the nest box and pull Monty out to rescue him. And it was this tiny little weird-looking creature, if you've ever seen pictures of owls when they're babies.
No,
yeah,
no.
Quite disturbing. Oh, no, beautiful. Because you have to care for them so intensively and keep them the correct temperature and feed them quite often, that's when they get really used to people. Mm-hmm. So that's how Monty became our wonderful ambassador. And then 2 years later, the same thing happened. We had more chicks hatch. They disappeared. We removed another one. And now we've got Bentley, our other wonderful ambassador. So that's why they're so relaxed. They're quite secretive species. I believe there was estimated to be about 500 breeding pairs left in Tasmania. And it's their habitat loss that's the biggest issue, the loss of the big tree hollows, like the old-growth logging. And they're really important for our ecosystem too, keeping all the rats and mice away. But, yeah, there's a couple of people at uni that are really getting into studying them.
because they're quite secretive at nighttime.
Yeah.
It makes it a bit tricky.
It does. Also makes it very special, the experience that you're now offering here as well.
Yeah, exactly, to be able to see them for so long and really appreciate the bird as it is and understand it more, and it's cool adaptations.
Senior keeper at Raptor Refuge, Juliet Harlow, with artist and volunteer Kate Shaw at Kettering in southern Tasmania, with reporter Lucy Cutting. Thanks to our reporters today, Jennifer Nichols, Lucy Cutting, Grace Nakamura and Annie Brown. Production this week by Serena Locke. I'm Clint Jasper. Join our reporters next week for a roam around a big country.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.